Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Environmental Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Brian Hamilton, your host today, and I'm over the moon to be joined by Dr. Kate Brown. She is professor of science, technology, and society at MIT, and the author of four very wonderful books. She's here to talk about the brand new one. It's called Manual for Survival, A Chernobyl Guide to the Future. It came out in March from W.W. Norton. Dr. Brown, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me here, Brian.
Now, it seems like we're in the middle of a Chernobyl moment all of a sudden. Your book is joined on the shelves this spring by two other new histories, focused more narrowly on the disaster itself, one by Adam Higginbotham and the other by Sergei Plokhy. And HBO is also going to begin airing a Chernobyl miniseries on May 6th. It looks very dramatic and quite gruesome from the trailer I've seen so far. And I'm wondering why we're seeing this upswing in attention to Chernobyl this year. I know later this month it's going to be the 33rd anniversary of the disaster, but that's not a thing. So can you explain it? And could you at least tell us what led you yourself to the project at this time?
Yeah, I can't really explain all the attention. I mean, it seems like the young people who are not alive when the accident occurred in April of 1986 are interested in this as something that's sort of like, you know, near history. And they like, you know, I think the ruin porn aspects of the Chernobyl disaster. You know, there's this world's largest abandoned territory. There's this ghost city. A very popular online game called Stalker, where it's a shooting game, video game, and people inhabit, you know, the Chernobyl zone. So I think that's sort of generating some of the commercial media interest in it. There's also been a big Russian TV miniseries about young people wandering through the Chernobyl zone and bumping into spooky things and zombies and things like that. But it's now history officially once we can get into the archives after 20 years of waiting to see files. We now can. And so that's what spurred me on to go into the archives. I had written a book called Plutopia about the first two cities in the world to produce plutonium. And at the end of that book, I talk about some of the health issues that I came across among farmers who lived downwind and downriver from these two big, extremely polluting plutonium plants. And these Russian and American farmers told me very similar stories about their health problems. And scientists I talked to said, no, well, those health problems can't be caused by their exposures to radiation because we don't have that kind of evidence to show the links. So I thought, well, Chernobyl was a civilian nuclear power plant. It happened at a later period when documents are more likely to be available. So I thought, you know, I'd just try to see what I could find out as kind of a sequel to Plutopia, because I felt like I didn't really properly get the health story in that book. And so when I walked in first in Kiev to the Ministry of the Archive, and I asked for the Ministry of Health records on the Chernobyl disaster, I hit pretty much a Klondike of records, just reams and reams of records about health problems. And I went to the Ministry of Agriculture and found tons of records about food and contaminated food, you know, radioactive sources that had saturated much of the food chain. And then I moved on to Belarus and Russia and down to the provincial and county archives. And I found that almost everywhere I went, I was one of the first researchers to sign out these files So that's what spurred me on to write this Chernobyl story.
And from your research, I mean, the book has already made headlines in the last month for one reason, it's challenged to this official Chernobyl death count, which for quite a while has stood at 54. Where did that number come from and why has it persisted for so long? And what would you say a more accurate number might look like?
That number comes from UN records. And there's been a number of UN reports, first one in 1986, and then a big one in 1991, 1996, and then the Chernobyl Forum report of 2006. And what that death count comes from is deaths that you cannot deny are caused by Chernobyl radioactivity. Those were firemen, nuclear plant operators, about 15 kids who died from having thyroid cancer, who lived in the contaminated areas. So that's the minimal count, but that has been the official count. It's one of the few counts that, for instance, the New York Times can cross-check if they're doing a story on it. I don't think many people believe that only 54 people died from the Chernobyl accident, and I certainly didn't believe it when I started this research. And the official count that the Ukrainians have is, well, they have two counts. One is that 35,000 people receive compensation because their spouses have died from a Chernobyl-related illness. That's 35,000, not 35. But then that only accounts people who were old enough to marry, who had their doses officially recorded so that they could then get the status as a liquidator. And that only accounts for Ukraine. There are no similar numbers for Russia or Belarus, I think simply because they haven't gathered them. So that 35,000 is a minimum number. Ukrainian officials give you a number of 150,000 as their guess of how many people have died in Ukraine alone. And keep in mind that Ukraine received the least amount of Chernobyl contamination compared to Belarus and Russia, where far more, you know, where the wind was blowing and far more radioactive fallout landed in those countries. So between 35,000 and 150,000 is the minimum number that we have. So that brings us closer to Greenpeace predictions of death counts than UN predictions.
Yeah, and you narrate the accident itself early in the book in just a couple of pages, and then you quickly leave the reactor behind and move further out. You narrate some about the zone of alienation, which you're saying, which often ends up on the internet in these photos we often see. But you move out from there as well, and you even move out in your research beyond the region blanketed by the bulk of the radioactive fallout. What led you to range so far?
Well, what I found is that when dealing with this accident and describing this accident, that focusing on the moment of the accident itself, and you'll find books that sort of have a second by second countdown of the events leading up to the night of April 26, 1986. And then you'll find lots of stories, media stories, and also histories that deal with the Chernobyl zone itself, this 30-kilometer circle that was depopulated in 1986, soon after the accident. And I find that both of those things, the temporal and the geographic limitation of the accident, are sort of like waving a red flag saying, oh, look, the accident's over here. And that's sort of a false impression we get, that the accident did not have a beginning. It does have a very clear beginning. But what I find is that there's a lot of radioactive contamination in these Pripyat marshes where the Chernobyl zone is that was there in the 1960s. In fact, people who lived in that swamp had 30 times more radioactivity in their bodies, according to a 1960s Soviet study, than people who lived in Minsk and Kiev. And so I was like, that's strange. So even before they started building that Chernobyl plant, that swamp that they put the plant in was saturated with radioactivity. Now, the Soviet source said it was from global fallout. Some records I found and some evidence I found showed that there was an Air Force bombing range inside that swamp and that they were possibly testing strategic. Those are small nuclear weapons. So what I found is that the contamination of that territory begins before the Chernobyl accident, and it continues long afterwards, so that there are about a dozen accidents, nuclear accidents in Ukraine after Chernobyl, after 1986. I was in the Chernobyl zone following biologists for this research for this book. And in 2017, there were big forest fires in the most radioactive part of the Chernobyl zone, which is the Red Forest. And that fire volatilized radioactivity that had been stored in the leaf litter and in the wood of fallen trees and branches. And that just went back up into the atmosphere again and created sort of a new event, a new, you know, pretty big nuclear event that wasn't really, you know, on anybody's radar. But when I got there, levels of radioactivity were extremely high. Instead of, I expected about 50 microsieverts, they were closer to 1,000. So what I found is that Chernobyl is an acceleration, certainly, of radioactivity emitted into the local Ukrainian environment. But it was not the first or the last event. In fact, it was something on a continuum of events that led me to zoom out and look at the bigger picture of the changes in the Northern Hemisphere after 1945, when bombs started to be developed and were tested around the world, but mostly, other than in the South Pacific and Australia, in the Northern Hemisphere. So I started to, as I say, think of Chernobyl as an acceleration, and that part of the reason we have these low death counts and we have this story that a rhetorical narrative that, look, Chernobyl was the humankind's largest nuclear disaster, and only 54 people died. So therefore, we're okay to go forward in the future with nuclear power. It's just not that big of a deal. Far more people die from coal. Far more people die in car accidents. You know, things start to get relativized. But you know, if you look at Chernobyl as an acceleration, you see that in the period of global testing that really sort of mounted up until 1963, when atmospheric test ban finally took place, just in one isotope alone, radioactive iodine, which is, you know, which goes right to this human thyroid and causes all kinds of health problems, that the two big powers, the Soviets and the Americans, emitted 500 times more radioactive iodine than Chernobyl during the course of nuclear testing. And so, and then what we see when you look at health records around the world is that global fallout landed in the Northern Hemisphere, and we find in the Northern Hemisphere alarming increases in things that are, you know, health problems that are, can be radiogenetic. That's rises in birth defects, childhood cancers, which used to be a medical rarity and which are no longer the case, a real increase in thyroid cancers that start in the 1970s and continue rising to this day for reasons that scientists don't really understand, steady growth in other cancers, including leukemias, which are very radiosensitive. And then this really troubling statistic that since 1945 in the Northern Hemisphere, male sperm counts have dropped in half. So what I talk about at the end of this, my book, Manual for Survival, is that this rise in this release of global fallout of radioactivity since 1945, and this increase in radiogenetic health problems are a correlation. We don't know if there's causation or a connection, but that I end my book wondering why we haven't been more curious as a society in our own exposures to nuclear fallout. You know, in many ways, we all live in the shadow of the mushroom cloud, not just people in the Chernobyl contaminated areas.
For a frightening book, which it is in part, full of ecological catastrophe and repressive politics, there are a surprising number of heroes. Your narrative is full of unfamous people, most of them women, whose kind of bravery and tenacity I think will leave quite an impression on readers. Would you tell your listeners about a couple of those?
Yeah, well, you know, one of the stories that the Soviet scientists, the big scientists who were on the international scene, one of the stories they use, and that some historians repeat without, you know, sort of checking this, is that, oh, if we had said anything about, you know, how Chernobyl was being mismanaged, we would have been thrown in the gulag, which no longer existed by 1980s, or we would have been shot. And that's just not true. I mean, no Soviet scientist was getting shot in the 1980s, nor in the 1970s. And what I find is that resistance to sort of glossing over Chernobyl problems on the ground as they were playing out was met with, you know, people got in trouble, people maybe got fined or demoted, but no one was severely punished. And often these sort of dissidents were very effective. So there was one guy, Pavel Chikronov, who lived in the provincial town of Zhytomyr, not very far from the Chernobyl plant. And he noticed that there was a lot of radioactive contaminants in the town's drinking reservoir. So he just did, you know, he just followed the trail and he up the stream and he located a tannery in the town of Berdichev, neighboring town. And the tannery had been processing radioactive hides from animals that had been slaughtered right after the accident, who had been underneath clouds of fallout. And they had changed the process to add extra baths and extra chromium to make sure that these hides were clean enough for commercial use. But that meant, you know, that radioactivity doesn't just go away. You just can only move it from one place to another until it decays on its own schedule. And so this radioactivity was flowing down the out of the factory's pipes and down the stream and into the Zhytomyr drinking reservoir. So what Chikronov did was he was a local sanitation inspector. He put a stop work order on that factory. He got in trouble for doing so. You know, officials in Moscow were like screaming, you know, how can you stop production, etc. But he held his ground, and inspectors came in from Kiev and they backed him up. There was another woman who was a physicist. She taught physics in Kiev, and she had access to a Geiger counter because her husband was a member of the civil defense team. And she started going around, and she would find these little particles, little hot spots of radioactivity right in her own courtyard of her apartment building and where she worked at the University of Kiev. And she picked up these particles and she showed them to me. She taped them onto pieces of paper, and she measured them. And there, you know, these little tiny specks of dust were ragingly hot, and they were. She was able to compute what isotopes they were, and she was able to compute what was going on 120 kilometers away at the Chernobyl plant as the fire raged. And so she remotely figured out what was at the time highly classified information, that the fire at the Chernobyl plant was burned for several weeks. And she also computed something that only was sort of finally accepted by the scientific community in 2016, when a Swedish team proved that the accident was not a steam or a chemical explosion. That's what we were told by the Soviet authorities right after it occurred, but that it was a nuclear explosion and that the radioactive contaminants went literally sky high and traveled in the stratosphere a long way, 1,500 kilometers, which is how we know that a part of the nuclear reactor actually blew up. So this woman, Natalia Lazitskaya, was very tuned in just by doing her own sort of citizen science.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
That's great. And Chernobyl exploded, as you kind of referenced this, that it exploded during this period of political reform, perestroika, and Gorbachev is calling for more transparency in government. And so I wonder if you could help us situate the disaster within the period's political history more. And we go from this period, you know, this point where these initial efforts to cover up the extent of the damage that you mentioned to what you say is, quote, the point when Chernobyl became politicized and monetized. How does that work?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, first, you know, there was a ban on Chernobyl as Chernobyl topics that had to do with health, radiation, or contaminants. And that ban lasted from 1986 to 1989. But in 1989, they lifted the ban. And as they did that, and they're lifting the ban in part because there was lots of pressure from down below, from really angry citizens who were writing letter after letter, and there are all these letters in the archives, saying, listen, we're living here. We've talked to our local radiation monitor, and you know, he let us know that we're living in really high levels of contamination. And we want to move. We want to get out of here. Our kids are sick. We're sick. And these citizens really did, you know, they're villagers. They're collective farmers. They often don't have a high school degree. But they armed themselves with a great deal of knowledge, somehow, probably being tipped off by local doctors and local bureaucrats and scientists. And they push for, you know, sort of from the ground up for a more open conversation about Chernobyl. And so finally in 1989, they released the maps of radioactivity, just, you know, they're black and white maps, really sort of crude maps, but they show the hotspots of contamination. And they show some really remarkable things that people had suspected but not known at the time. You know, even doctors were not able to get this information. One fact that they learned is that there, you know, the hotspots of radioactivity were right around the plant, but also as you traveled northeast away from the plant, there was another almost, you know, ragingly hot spot on about 200 kilometers away in the southern Belarus province of Mogilev. And in that province, I learned Soviet pilots, days after the accident, had gone up, manipulated the weather to make radioactive rain fall down in rural Belarus because they feared a storm front which was heading towards the big Russian cities and was going to drop lots of thunder and rain and radioactive fallout onto the big Russian cities of Yaroslavl and Voronezh and Moscow. So in order to save those big cities, they had it rain in a sparsely populated rural area. The only problem is they didn't tell anybody in Belarus they had done that. And so when those maps were published in 1989 with Perestroika, that was like, you know, throwing a match in the gasworks. It just blew up. And people were out in the streets. Plant workers were striking. Activists made pilgrimages around to these areas. Villagers, you know, stopped working, started protesting. And that led to all kinds of people coming forward with their stories. Doctors came forward and researchers came forward, especially from the contaminated areas. And they announced, and Belarusian leaders also announced, they sort of, you know, changed their tune and said, you know, what we have on our hands is a public health disaster. We cannot handle the biological load that we have. You know, a KGB general is writing in through classified channels saying that he's got a clinic with 2,000 patients in it, and he's found that there are 12 different radioactive radionuclides located in the bodies of his patients, and that they cause a whole, you know, a once healthy person to become sick on many different levels. And he sort of documents this all very well. And he says, you know, and I have the best study in the world for this because I have this KGB clinic that has, you know, well-paid staff that's allowed access to dose records, which civilian doctors were not allowed access to, and all the up-to-date latest medical equipment. So as the story of this public health disaster hits the news, the Belarusian and Ukrainian governments asked to move about 200,000 more people from highly contaminated areas. And that's going to cost a lot of money. Moscow is now out of money. Soviet economy is in ruins by 1990. So they ask international experts to come in. First, they ask the World Health Organization to come in and do an assessment. Do these people need to be moved? Do we need to be taking any additional measures? World Health sends in three nuclear experts, and they spend about less than 10 days touring around the contaminated areas, talking to villagers. And they say at the end of that 10 days, there's no need to do anything. We don't see any problems, health problems related to the accident. And the permissible limits that the Soviets have set are fine. In fact, you could raise them, you could double them, or even triple them. So nobody believed this really quick World Health Organization study. It was, you know, what could you do in 10 days? So then the Soviet government asked the International Atomic Energy Agency to do the same thing, to do a more serious study of fallout effects. So they sent in what they say is 200 scientists who made sort of quick trips, you know, rotating in, 2 weeks out, over about 18 months. And they said the same thing. You know, we saw a lot of health problems after looking at a small contingency of about 1,600 people. They did have elevated, you know, health problems, but that those health problems could not possibly be related to Chernobyl because the doses were too low. And the doses they were calculating, they were extrapolating those doses from the high-level one-shot X-ray that survivors had gotten in Japan from the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombings. And they were saying, compared to Hiroshima and Nagasaki, these doses that these villagers are getting are too low. So, you know, their health problems cannot be related to Chernobyl contamination. What I find, and I went on to work in a number of different UN agencies' archives, what I find is that a few key opinion makers in the UN, I'm not talking about a UN-wide conspiracy, but a few key opinion makers, particularly in the International Atomic Energy Agency and the UN Scientific Committee for Effects on Atomic Radiation, went around and made a sort of a lobbying effort to get other UN agencies that had very good programs in the works to do something about Chernobyl, to help out with Chernobyl. They went around and discouraged that any funding should happen based on Chernobyl. They also, as they did their study, they designed the study to find only catastrophic health effects. And then they never mentioned that they were only looking for catastrophic health effects. They said, we did a medical study. But then when they did find catastrophic health effects, which was a significant, a very large rise in children with thyroid cancer, which is normally very rare, 1 in 1 million kids get it. Suddenly like 20 kids in a small territory of northern Ukraine come up with this thyroid cancer, and 30 in southern Belarus. And suddenly they have this thyroid cancer epidemic on their hands. So when they learned that, they didn't believe it. They took the biopsies back to the United States to have them verified. They checked out, but they did not include that information in their report. They said that stories about a rise in thyroid cancer among children were anecdotal. And it certainly wasn't anecdotal when they had the evidence in hand and they had checked it themselves. So I find these kinds of things are going on among international experts as they make a case about the effects of Chernobyl's health problems. Now, you might ask, why would they do that?
I was going to ask that, yeah.
That was my question. what I find is that at that same time, early 1990s, throughout the 1990s, the big nuclear powers, the U.S., U.K., France, Russia, particularly, were facing lawsuits from their own record of testing and producing nuclear weapons during the Cold War. And they had just had thousands of people who were saying that they had been exposed, either because they were downwind from tests or because they lived near nuclear bomb production plants or because they worked in those production plants or they were atomic veterans. And they were suing their governments because of their health problems. And these states were on the line for billions of dollars of liability. But if you could say, look, we did a study, found no health effects from Chernobyl, and only 35 people died, then you could make those lawsuits potentially go away. And that's indeed what happened in the 1990s and the early 2000s. Very few of those lawsuits ever amounted to substantial awards for people who made the case that they had been exposed.
Well, and now today, the global politics of Chernobyl have hardly cooled down much, though I think they have transformed. You know, there's really no issue that sets environmentalists against one another like nuclear power. And as a little personal story, I maintain a very anodyne Twitter presence in general. I'm not out there, you know, in a flame war with anybody. But when I promoted this interview coming up, and I was excited to read the book, suddenly I checked back in the afternoon, and a very prominent environmentalist, a pro-nuclear environmentalist, suddenly was blowing up my feed, and there to call your book junk science and to liken you to an anti-vaxxer. And I'm not going to ask you to respond to that kind of ad hominem attack. And I think your many, many 70 pages of footnotes can speak for themselves. And I should be clear, you don't. This is not a polemic that you wrote here. You don't call for the shuttering of nuclear power plants or for a moratorium on new constructions. And you even begin the book by saying, you know, maybe nuclear power is the best option to reduce carbon emissions and supply energy for a growing global population. So I'm wondering then, instead, what role would you be pleased to see Manual for Survival play in this sort of civil war among environmentalists?
Well, I think that, you know, part of the problem, you know, is this sort of like, you know, black and white polemic between, you know, those who are for nuclear power and those who are against nuclear power. And I, you know, I started working on both Plutopia and this book as an agnostic about this issue. You know, as an environmentalist, I think we have to do really serious things quite soon to solve the problem of climate change, and maybe nuclear power is that. But I also want to make sure that if we do embrace a new generation of nuclear power reactors, and we keep the old ones that are going now 40 years still going, I think we should do that with our eyes wide open, not with stale reports that are 2006 reports that are recycled from 1991 reports, but that we should have fresh information and real studies. You know, every scientist who commented on Chernobyl, nearly everyone after 1986, said, you know, we need to do a big long-term study akin to the atomic bomb survivor studies on these Chernobyl survivors. And that's the one thing that never happened. And it didn't happen because these few individuals from, you know, denoted as international nuclear experts stepped in and said that wasn't necessary. And a big UN pledge drive that was going on in 1991 that was going to funnel $1 billion towards Chernobyl disaster relief didn't get funded because of these influential individuals. And so we don't have a study today. And that's what my book calls for. We've got all these records. It's the only case in the world that where we have available records where we know we can see the experience medically and in terms of doses of what happened to people right after a nuclear event. The Hiroshima studies started in 1950, 5 years after the bombing. And so much of that, what that is a retrospective dose reconstruction of what scientists believe or estimate Japanese survivors got. And they did that by asking people, you know, where were you standing 5 years ago when the bomb went off? And we know from oral history that memories are not always very, very precise, and that to base a whole science of radiation medicine on human memory is probably a major flaw. The other problem we have with the Hiroshima studies is that they were controlled by the Americans into the 1970s. And the Americans were really anxious, especially right after the bombs fell, that nuclear weapons would be designated, as were chemical weapons after World War I, as unfair, inhumane weapons in warfare. And that would mean that the major investment the Americans made in producing those two different kinds of nuclear bombs would have been lost. They would have, you know, had these nuclear plants that would have, bomb plants that would have, you know, they would have had to just shutter right away. And so if you could come out of those studies, if you could do a study on bomb survivors and say, you know, only the people who were, you know, got struck by the strongest shock waves were killed, and they were killed mostly for conventional reasons, from burns, not from some kind of what the Japanese were calling an atomic poison, then you could say that this was a legitimate future for nuclear weapons. It was a legitimate weapon. And that's exactly what the American Atomic Energy Commission sought to do, was to kind of run these studies so that atomic weaponry didn't look so bad. And that's meant that there's no long-lasting effects. So indeed, the atomic bomb studies found that there were no genetic repercussions. But one of the ways they did that was by not accounting for fallout. They really, the dose that they estimate to this day is just a dose that survivors got in less than a second. You know, it was just one big X-ray. But the fallout that occurred after the bombs fell was not taken into account. And so what Chernobyl offers us is fresh data taken about the exposures of people immediately after an accident, and a different kind of experience, an experience in which people were living not with one just big X-ray, but long-term, you know, chronic exposures to low doses of radioactivity. And that's far more likely to occur in our future. We're hopefully not going to have a nuclear war. And if we do, we probably won't be having these discussions anyways, because there won't be many discussions. But we probably will have more nuclear accidents in reactors and processing plants with waste facilities. And so chronic low doses is really the question that we need to have answered for our future.
You contributed an essay that draws on some of this research to an exciting 2017 volume edited by anthropologist Anna Singh and others called Arts of Living on a Damaged Planet. And in your book now, you describe that during your travels, you were on the lookout for people you termed survival artists. And I wonder if you could tell us about one of them you came across and what we can learn from them.
I'm trying to think of the one, the survival artist that might be most interesting for this story. You know what? There was a woman I spent a lot of time with who was living in Pripyat and working at the Chernobyl plant when the plant exploded. And she was evacuated to a village. The village, she quickly determined, was more radioactive than the city of Pripyat from which she'd been evacuated to. And so she got herself and her two young sons on a bus to Kiev and got to the train station in Kiev. And there she got a ticket to Moscow, where she went to stay with her sister. But in Moscow, her son started to exhibit signs of radiation sickness. He started to throw up and felt very poorly. So they called the hospital, and you know, the emergency ambulance crew came over, and they were all wrapped up, like she says, in Saran wrap. And they, you know, came with Geiger counters, and they took everything, you know, all their possessions that were radioactive, and took them with them, and brought this friend of mine and her two kids to the hospital. And there they stayed in the hospital for a couple of months. And that's the interesting thing. You know, the official count is that 300 people were hospitalized after the accident. That number comes from the fact that the Moscow officials said, you know, we're only going to talk about hospitalized patients in one hospital in Moscow where the firemen were sent to. But we're not going to mention anybody else. And the only reason they talked about the ones where the firemen were is because one American doctor, Robert Gale, was helping out at the hospital at the time. And so he was obviously, you know, a witness to it. But instead of 300 people hospitalized, I find that the number is 40,000 hospitalized just in the three republics immediately around the Chernobyl zone. And so survival artist I'm talking to was in the hospital with her kids as part of this hospitalization. And when she was released, she had no place to go, and she was basically homeless and penniless. And amazingly, as soon as she got a chance, she went right back to the rebuilt town that was going to support the still going Chernobyl plant. It's a town called Slavutich. And that's where I met her. And I just had to admire her commitment to her community. That's why she went back. She missed her friends and neighbors in this town of Pripyat. So she went back to work at the Chernobyl plant when it opened in 1989 and moved into the newly built replacement town of Pripyat. And, you know, she sang in the choir and she knew everybody. And what I admired about her is that on the days that she felt good and she had health problems, and not every day that she felt good, she was, you know, she would break out into a song. She'd do a little dance. She'd laughed a lot. She showed me around and introduced me to everybody else around. And I think those qualities of sort of being left to struggle on your own with these problems and sort of mobilizing, you know, your own resources and those of your community and drawing on them. I had a lot of admiration for that.
Thanks. I would say also that your book, Putopia, your second book, is perhaps the most loved environmental history published this decade. And fans of that book, and there are many, will find in Manual for Survival, in the new book, you deploy even more fully this accessible first-person narrative style that you used in places throughout that book. And I kept thinking as I was reading it, it read kind of like a 300-page magazine article. And I mean that in the best possible way. It was sort of a long, long read. But what was I really struck by was that even though it's not academic in that prose style, it offers actually, I think, a clearer picture of a scholar at work and a researcher at work than we almost ever get in a typical academic history with its voice from nowhere. And I wondered if you could just say a little bit about your decision to adopt the prose style you did and any challenges you had doing so.
It really wasn't much of a decision for me. I've always written my histories in the first person because I think it's important. We know that what we do is not objective. We no longer claim that history is some objective science or social science. And that therefore, it seems to me like we need to bring our readers along so that they understand how we got the story, what was our quest, and what are our queries, and what are some of the problems we run into as we try to get this story. So that I think that offers the reader better abilities to evaluate the kind of material I'm going to get. And I knew that this was going to be a controversial topic, and indeed it has. My inbox and my email has not stopped now for weeks since this book came out a couple of weeks ago. What I was thinking is, here is all this complicated material, highly technical, sometimes contradictory. I would find, in the same archive, assertions that there were no medical problems caused by Chernobyl, and I'd turn the page and there'd be another person asserting there's a ton of medical problems caused precisely by Chernobyl. And so I'm busy sorting out actively, audibly in this book, these different voices and how do I deal with them? And I finally figured out that, I'm in the middle of the 2016 WikiLeaks scandal and the evidence that the Russian government meddled in the U.S. elections and as well as the Brexit elections. And I couldn't help but think, be influenced by that environment. And I couldn't help but think, maybe some of this information in the archive was planted there specifically for some historian like me to find in the future and be misled, that archives do lie. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, archives lie, but maybe trees don't. And so I called up the only two biologists I could find who consistently work in the zone, and Tim Musso and Anders Moller go twice a year regularly in June and September. They're easy to find in the zone, and they generously invited me along on their trips whenever I could. And so I went with them and learned a lot from them about radioecology. And I learned how to read a forest or a swamp or any kind of those natural environments for radioactive damage. A lot of people go into the Chernobyl zone. They're like, look, there's a tree and there's a bird. The Chernobyl zone is thriving, is the conclusion. And that's it's a real easy trope that comes out of not a lot of scientific evidence. There's just a couple of articles that have that story, but it comes out of a real human desire to have this story, have nature fix things, fix our human messes, I think. But what I learned from Musso and Moller is that trees don't lie, indeed, that you can see the sort of grip of a radioactive hand on a tree, especially vulnerable pine trees, and they quickly get they can easily be distorted or get mutations that cause the wood itself to twist and bend. Pine trees were grown in this area to be bored straight to be used as lumber, but here you have these sort of wickedly twisted trees with the pine needles themselves, which are supposed to be also straight and all oriented in the same direction, that are twisting around. And I started to, be able to understand that when you can smell radioactivity in a forest, because if you get to a part of the forest where there's not those usual forest smells, which often come from decomposition, the smell of things decomposing, decomposition slows down greatly when there's high levels of radioactivity because there are not the microbes and the insects to take apart organic matter. So these kinds of things I learned, and I, again, took my readers along on those adventures so that they could understand how I tried to cross-check the sources I found in the archives with sources that I located in the environment and with people who I met along the way.
Before we let you get back to your email inbox, I wondered if I could ask if you're able to see the horizon beyond what I'm sure is an exhausting season of press that awaits you. Do you have any sense of what projects you might turn to next?
A little bit, yeah. I'm interested now that we know that trees are sentient and have sensory abilities and that they have a distributed intelligence. I'm curious in the people who knew that a long time ago, you know, long before Western science came to that conclusion in the last 5 years, you know, peasants in the Ukrainian forest would talk about the spirits of the trees and spirits of different plants. Rogue scientists have been saying similar things for, you know, 50, 60 years. So I want to go back in time and look at these sort of indigenous and rogue sources of scientific knowledge that have been discredited, but now they're not discredited. And so I think if we're going to solve some of our big environmental crises of the future, we're going to have to return to indigenous knowledge and indigenous skills. And I want to write a book that starts to explore that path.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, we'll be looking out for that. The book again today is Manual for Survival, A Chernobyl Guide to the Future. It's by Kate Brown, and it's available now. Go get your copy from Norton. Dr. Brown, thank you so much for your time and for your work.
Thank you, Brian. Appreciate it.